suffrage and workers' rights. It was also sacralized under the halo of human rights and held out as a symbol of the kind of society we choose to live in and the kind of people we choose to be. The abolitionist elites in Europe got their way over the misgivings of the common man because European democracies did not convert the opinions of the common man into policy. The penal codes of their countries were drafted by committees of renowned scholars, passed into law by legislators who thought of themselves as a natural aristocracy, and implemented by appointed judges who were lifelong civil servants. It was only after a couple of decades had elapsed and people saw that their country had not fallen into chaos, at which point it would have taken a concerted effort to reintroduce capital punishment, that the populace came around to seeing it as unnecessary. But the United States, for better or worse, is closer to having government by the people, for the people. Other than for a few federal crimes like terrorism and treason, the death penalty is decided upon by individual states, voted on by legislators who are close to their constituents, and in many states sought and approved by prosecutors and judges who have to stand for re-election. Southern states have a long-standing culture of honor with its ethos of justified retaliation, and not surprisingly, American executions are concentrated in a handful of southern states, mainly Texas, Georgia, and Missouri, indeed in a handful of counties in those states. Yet the United States, too, has been swept by the historical current, and capital punishment is on the way out despite its continuing popular appeal, with 61% in favor in 2015. Seven states have repealed the death penalty in the past decade, an additional 16 have moratoria, and 30 have not executed anyone in 5 years. Even Texas executed only 7 prisoners in 2016, compared with 40 in 2000. Figure 14-4 shows the steady decline of the use of the death penalty in the United States, with what may be a final slide to zero visible in the rightmost segment. And true to the pattern in Europe, as the practice becomes obsolescent, public opinion straggles behind. In 2016, popular support for the death penalty slipped just below 50% for the first time in almost 50 years. How can the United States be doing away with capital punishment almost despite itself? Here we see another path along which moral progress can take place. Though the American political system is more populist than those of its Western peers, it still falls short of being a direct participatory democracy like ancient Athens, which, pointedly, put Socrates to death. With the historical expansion of sympathy and reason, even the staunchest fans of capital punishment have lost their stomach for lynch mobs, hanging judges, and rowdy public executions, and insist that the practice be carried out with a modicum of dignity and care. That requires an intricate apparatus of death and a team of mechanics to run and repair it. As the machine wears out and the mechanics refuse to maintain it, it becomes increasingly unwieldy and invites being scrapped. The American death penalty is not so much being abolished as falling apart, piece by piece. First, advances in forensic science, particularly DNA fingerprinting, have shown that innocent people have almost certainly been put to death, a scenario that unnerves even ardent supporters of the death penalty. Second, the grisly business of snuffing out a life has evolved from the gory sadism of crucifixion and disembowelment to the quick but still graphic ropes, bullets, and blades, to the invisible agents of gas and electricity, to the pseudo-medical procedure of lethal injection. But doctors refuse to administer it. Pharmaceutical companies refuse to supply the drugs, and witnesses are disturbed by the death throes during botched attempts. Third, the chief alternative to the death penalty, life in prison, has become more reliable as escape-proof and riot-proof penitentiaries have been perfected. Fourth, as the rate of violent crime has plummeted, Chapter 12, people feel less need for draconian remedies. Fifth, because the death penalty is seen as such a momentous undertaking, the summary executions of earlier eras have given way to a drawn-out legal ordeal. The sentencing phase after a guilty verdict is tantamount to a second trial, and a death sentence triggers a lengthy process of reviews and appeals. so lengthy that most death row prisoners die of natural causes. Meanwhile, the billable hours from expensive lawyers cost the state 8 times as much as life in prison. Sixth, social disparities in death sentences, with poor and black defendants disproportionately being put to death, those without the capital get the punishment, have weighed increasingly on the nation's conscience. Finally, the Supreme Court, which is repeatedly tasked with formulating a consistent rationale for this crazy quilt, has struggled to rationalize the practice and has chipped away at it piece by piece. In recent years, it has ruled that states may not execute juveniles, people with intellectual disabilities, or perpetrators of crimes other than murder. And it came close to ruling against the hit-and-miss method of lethal injection. Court watchers believe it is only a matter of time before the justices are forced to confront the caprice of the whole macabre practice head-on, invoke evolving standards of decency, and strike it down as a violation of the Eighth Amendment's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment once and for all. The uncanny assemblage of scientific, institutional, legal, and social forces, all pushing to strip government of its power to kill, makes it seem as if there really is a mysterious arc bending toward justice. More prosaically, we are seeing a moral principle, life is sacred, so killing is onerous, become distributed across a wide range of actors and institutions that have to cooperate to make the death penalty possible. As these actors and institutions implement the principle more consistently and thoroughly, they inexorably push the country away from the impulse to avenge a life with a life. The pathways are manifold and tortuous, the effects are slow and then sudden, but in the fullness of time an idea from the Enlightenment can transform the world. Chapter 15. Equal Rights. Humans are liable to treat entire categories of other humans as means to an end, or nuisances to be cast aside. Coalitions bound by race or creed seek to dominate rival coalitions. Men try to control the labor, freedom, and sexuality of women. People translate their discomfort with sexual nonconformity into moralistic condemnation. We call these phenomena racism, sexism, and homophobia. And they have been rampant to varying degrees in most cultures throughout history. The disavowal of these evils is a large part of what we call civil rights or equal rights. The historical expansion of these rights, the stories of Selma, Seneca Falls, and Stonewall, is a stirring chapter in the story of human progress. The rights of racial minorities, women, and gay people continue to advance, each recently emblazoned on a milestone. The year 2017 saw the completion of 2 terms in office by the first African-American president, an achievement movingly captured by First Lady Michelle Obama in a speech at the Democratic National Convention in 2016. "I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves, and I watch my daughters, 2 beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn." Barack Obama was succeeded by the first woman nominee of a major party in a presidential election less than a century after American women were even allowed to vote. She won a solid plurality of the popular vote, and would have been president were it not for peculiarities of the Electoral College system and other quirks of that election year. In a parallel universe very similar to this one, until November 8, 2016, the world's 3 most influential nations, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Germany, are all led by women. And in 2015, just a dozen years after it ruled that homosexual activity may not be criminalized, the Supreme Court guaranteed the right of marriage to same-sex couples. But it's in the nature of progress that it erases its tracks, and its champions fixate on the remaining injustices and forget how far we have come. An axiom of progressive opinion, especially in universities, is that we continue to live in a deeply racist, sexist, and homophobic society, which would imply that progressivism is a waste of time, having accomplished nothing after decades of struggle. Like other forms of progressophobia, the denial of advances in rights has been abetted by sensational headlines. A string of highly publicized killings by American police officers of unarmed African-American suspects, some of them caught on smartphone videos, has led to a sense that the country is suffering an epidemic of racist attacks by police on black men. Media coverage of athletes who have assaulted their wives or girlfriends, and of episodes of rape on college campuses, has suggested to many that we are undergoing a surge of violence against women. And one of the most heinous crimes in American history took place in 2016, when Omar Mateen opened fire at a gay nightclub in Orlando, killing 49 people and wounding another 53. The belief in an absence of progress has been fortified by the recent history of the universe we do live in, where Donald Trump, rather than Hillary Clinton, was the beneficiary of the American electoral system in 2016. During his campaign, Trump uttered misogynistic, anti-Hispanic, and anti-Muslim insults that were well outside the norms of American political discourse, and the rowdy followers he encouraged at his rallies were even more offensive. Some commentators worried that his victory represented a turning point in the nation's progress toward equality and rights, or that it uncovered the ugly truth that we had never made progress in the first place. The goal of this chapter is to plumb the depths of the current that carries equal rights along. Is it an illusion, a turbulent whirlpool atop a stagnant pond? Does it easily change direction and flow backwards? Or does justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a mighty stream? I'll end with a coda about progress in the rights of the most easily victimized sector of humanity, children. By now you should be skeptical about reading history from the headlines, and that applies to the recent assaults on equal rights. The data suggest that the number of police shootings has decreased, not increased, in recent decades, even as the ones that do occur are captured on video. And three independent analyses have found that a black suspect is no more likely than a white suspect to be killed by the police. American police shoot too many people, but it's not primarily a racial issue. A spate of news about rape cannot tell us whether there is now more violence against women, a bad thing, or whether we now care more about violence against women, a good thing. And to this day, it is unclear whether the Orlando nightclub massacre was committed out of homophobia, sympathy for ISIS, or the drive for posthumous notoriety that motivates most rampage shooters. Better first drafts of history can be gleaned from data on values and from vital statistics. The Pew Research Center has probed Americans' opinions on race, gender, and sexual orientation over the past quarter century, and has reported that these attitudes have undergone a fundamental shift toward tolerance and respect of rights, with formerly widespread prejudices sinking into oblivion. The shift is visible in figure 15-1, which plots reactions to three survey statements that are representative of many others. Other surveys show the same shifts. Not only has the American population become more liberal, but each generational cohort is more liberal than the one born before it. As we will see, people tend to carry their values with them as they age. So the millennials, those born after 1980, who are even less prejudiced than the national average, tell us which way the country is going. Of course, one can wonder whether figure 15-1 displays a decline in prejudice or simply a decline in the social acceptability of prejudice, with fewer people willing to confess their disreputable attitudes to a pollster. The problem has long haunted social scientists, but recently the economist Seth Stevens Davidowitz has discovered an indicator of attitudes that is the closest we've come to a digital truth serum. In the privacy of their keyboards and screens, people query Google with every curiosity, anxiety, and guilty pleasure you can imagine, together with many you can't imagine. Common searches include, how to make my penis bigger, and my vagina smells like fish. Google has amassed big data on the strings that people search for in different months and regions, though not the identity of the searchers, together with tools for analyzing them. Stevens Davidowitz discovered that searches for the word nigger, mostly in pursuit of racist jokes, correlate with other indicators of racial prejudice across regions, such as vote totals for Barack Obama in 2008, that were lower than expected for a Democrat. He suggests that these searches can serve as an unobtrusive indicator of private racism. Let's use them to track recent trends in racism. And while we're at it, private sexism and homophobia as well. Well into my adolescence, jokes featuring dumb Poles, ditzy dames, and lisping, limp-wristed homosexuals were common in network television and newspaper comics. Today they are taboo in mainstream media. But do bigoted jokes remain a private indulgence, or have private attitudes changed so much that people feel offended, sullied, or bored by them? Figure 15-2 shows the results. The curves suggest that Americans are not just more abashed about confessing to prejudice than they used to be, they privately don't find it as amusing. And contrary to the fear that the rise of Trump reflects or emboldens prejudice, the curves continue their decline through his period of notoriety in 2015 to 2016 and inauguration in early 2017. Stephen Zdavidowicz has pointed out to me that these curves probably underestimate the decline in prejudice because of a shift in who's Googling. When the records began in 2004, Googlers were mostly young and urban. Older and rural people tend to be latecomers to technology. And if they are the ones who are likelier to search for the offensive terms, that would inflate the proportion in later years and conceal the extent of the decline in bigotry. Google doesn't record the searchers' ages or levels of education, but it does record where the searches come from. In response to my query, Stephen Zdavidowicz confirmed that bigoted searches tended to come from regions with older and less educated populations. Compared with the country as a whole, retirement communities are 7 times as likely to search for nigger jokes and 30 times as likely to search for fag jokes. Google AdWords, he told me apologetically, doesn't give data on bitch jokes. Stephen Zdavidowicz also got his hands on a trove of search data from AOL, which, unlike Google, tracks the searches made by individuals, though not, of course, their identities. These threads confirmed that racists may be a dwindling breed. Someone who searches for nigger is likely to search for other topics that appeal to senior citizens, such as Social Security and Frank Sinatra. The main exception was a sliver of teenagers who also searched for bestiality, decapitation videos, and child pornography. Anything you're not supposed to search for. But aside from these transgressive youths, and there have always been transgressive youths, private prejudice is declining with time and declining with youth, which means that we can expect it to decline still further as aging bigots cede the stage to less prejudiced cohorts. Until they do, these older and less educated people, mainly white men, may not respect the benign taboos on racism, sexism, and homophobia that have become second nature to the mainstream, and may even dismiss them as political correctness. Today they can find each other on the internet and coalesce under a demagogue. As we will see in Chapter 20, Trump's success, like that of right-wing populists in other Western countries, is better understood as the mobilization of an aggrieved and shrinking demographic in a polarized political landscape than as the sudden reversal of a century-long movement toward equal rights. Progress in equal rights may be seen not just in political milestones and opinion bellwethers, but in data on people's lives. Among African Americans, the poverty rate fell from 55% in 1960 to 27.6% in 2011. Life expectancy rose from 33 in 1900, 17.6 years below that of whites, to 75.6 years in 2015, less than 3 years below whites. African Americans who make it to 65 have longer lives ahead of them than white Americans of the same age. The rate of illiteracy fell among African Americans from 45% in 1900 to effectively 0% today. As we will see in the next chapter, the racial gap in children's readiness for school has been shrinking. As we will see in Chapter 18, so has the racial gap in happiness. Racist violence against African Americans, once a regular occurrence in night raids and lynchings, 3 a week at the turn of the 20th century, plummeted in the 20th century and has fallen further since the FBI started amalgamating reports on hate crimes in 1996, as Figure 15-3 shows. Very few of these crimes are homicides, in most years one or zero. The slight uptick in 2015, the most recent year available, cannot be blamed on Trump, since it parallels the uptick in violent crime that year, see Figure 12-2, and hate crimes track rates of overall lawlessness more closely than they do remarks by politicians. Figure 15-3 shows that hate crimes against Asian, Jewish, and white targets have declined as well. And despite claims that Islamophobia has become rampant in America, hate crimes targeting Muslims have shown little change other than a one-time rise following 9/11, and upticks following other Islamist terror attacks, such as the ones in Paris and San Bernardino in 2015. At the time of this writing, FBI data from 2016 are not available, so it's premature to accept the widespread claims of a Trumpist surge in hate crimes that year. The claims come from advocacy organizations whose funding depends on whipping up fear, rather than disinterested record keepers. Some of the incidents were ironic hoaxes, and many were boorish outbursts rather than actual crimes. Aside from post-terrorist and crime-related blips, the trend in hate crimes is downward. Women's status, too, is ascendant. As recently as my childhood, American women in most states could not take out a loan or credit card in their own names, had to look for jobs in the Help Wanted Female section of the classified ads, and could not press charges of rape against their husbands. Today, women make up 47% of the labor force and a majority of university students. Violence against women is best measured by victimization surveys because they circumvent the problem of underreporting to the police. These instruments show that rates of rape and violence against wives and girlfriends have been sinking for decades and are now at a quarter or less of their peaks in the past. Figure 15-4. Too many of these crimes still take place, but we should be encouraged by the fact that a heightened concern about violence against women is not futile moralizing, but has brought measurable progress, which means that continuing this concern can lead to greater progress still. No form of progress is inevitable, but the historical erosion of racism, sexism, and homophobia are more than a change in fashion. As we will see, it seems to be pushed along by the tide of modernity. In a cosmopolitan society, people rub shoulders, do business, and find themselves in the same boat with other kinds of people, and that tends to make them more sympathetic to one another. Also, as people are forced to justify the way they treat other people, rather than dominating them out of instinctive, religious, or historical inertia, any justification for prejudicial treatment will crumble under scrutiny. Racial segregation, male-only suffrage, and the criminalization of homosexuality are literally indefensible. People tried to defend them in their times, and they lost the argument. These forces can prevail over the long term even against the tug of populist backlash. The global momentum toward abolition of the death penalty, Chapter 14, despite its perennial popular appeal, offers a lesson in the messy ways of progress. As indefensible or unworkable ideas fall by the wayside, they are removed from the pool of thinkable options, even among those who like to think that they think the unthinkable, and the political fringe is dragged forward despite itself. That's why even in the most regressive political movement in recent American history, there were no calls for reinstating Jim Crow laws, ending women's suffrage, or recriminalizing homosexuality. Racial and ethnic prejudice is declining not just in the West, but worldwide. In 1950, almost half the world's countries had laws that discriminated against ethnic or racial minorities, including, of course, the United States. By 2003, fewer than a fifth did, and they were outnumbered by countries with affirmative action policies that favored disadvantaged minorities. A huge 2008 survey by the World Public Opinion Poll of 21 developed and developing nations found that in every one, large majorities of respondents, around 90% on average, say that it's important for people of different races, ethnicities, and religions to be treated equally. Notwithstanding the habitual self-flagellation by Western intellectuals about Western racism, it's non-Western countries that are the least tolerant. But even in India, the country at the bottom of the list, 59% of the respondents affirmed racial equality, and 76% affirmed religious equality. With women's rights, too, the progress is global. In 1900, women could vote in only one country, New Zealand. Today they can vote in every country in which men can vote but one, Vatican City. Women make up almost 40% of the labor force worldwide, and more than a fifth of the members of national parliaments. The World Opinion Poll and Pew Global Attitudes Project have each found that more than 85% of their respondents believe in full equality for men and women, with rates ranging from 60% in India to 88% in six Muslim-majority countries, to 98% in Mexico and the United Kingdom. In 1993, the UN General Assembly adopted a declaration on the elimination of violence against women. Since then, most countries have implemented laws and public awareness campaigns to reduce rape, forced marriage, child marriage, genital mutilation, honor killings, domestic violence, and wartime atrocities. Though some of these measures are toothless, there are grounds for optimism over the long term. Global shaming campaigns, even when they start out as purely aspirational, have in the past led to dramatic reductions in slavery, dueling, whaling, foot-binding, piracy, privateering, chemical warfare, apartheid, and atmospheric nuclear testing. Female genital mutilation is an example, though still practiced in 29 African countries, together with Indonesia, Iraq, India, Pakistan, and Yemen. A majority of both men and women in those countries believe it should stop, and over the past 30 years, rates have fallen by a third. In 2016, the Pan-African Parliament, working with the UN Population Fund, endorsed a ban on the practice, together with child marriage. Gay rights is another idea whose time has come. Homosexual acts used to be a criminal offense in almost every country in the world. The first arguments that behavior between consenting adults is no one else's business were formulated during the Enlightenment by Montesquieu, Voltaire, Beccaria, and Bentham. A smattering of countries decriminalized homosexuality soon thereafter, and the number shot up with the gay rights revolution of the 1970s. Though homosexuality is still a crime in more than 70 countries, and a capital crime in 11 Islamic ones, and despite backsliding in Russia and several African countries, the global trend, encouraged by the UN and every human rights organization, continues toward liberalization. Figure 15-5 shows the timeline. In the past 6 years, an additional 8 countries have stricken homosexuality from their criminal codes. The worldwide progress against racism, sexism, and homophobia, even with its bumpiness and setbacks, can feel like an overarching sweep. Martin Luther King Jr. famously quoted the abolitionist Theodore Parker's image of an ark bending toward justice. Parker confessed that he could not complete the ark by sight, but could divine it by conscience. Is there a more objective way of determining whether there is a historical arc toward justice, and if so, what bends it? One view of the moral arc is provided by the World Values Survey, which has polled 150,000 people in more than 95 countries containing almost 90% of the world's population over a span of several decades. In his book, Freedom Rising, the political scientist Christian Veltzel, building on a collaboration with Ron Engelhardt, Pippa Norris, and others, has proposed that the process of modernization has stimulated the rise of emancipative values. As societies shift from agrarian to industrial to informational, their citizens become less anxious about fending off enemies and other existential threats, and more eager to express their ideals and to pursue opportunities in life. This shifts their values toward greater freedom for themselves and others. The transition is consistent with the psychologist Abraham Maslow's theory of a hierarchy of needs from survival and safety to belonging, esteem, and self-actualization, and with Brecht's grub first, then ethics. People begin to prioritize freedom over security, diversity over uniformity, autonomy over authority, creativity over discipline, and individuality over conformity. Emancipated values may also be called liberal values, in the classical sense related to liberty and liberation, rather than the sense of political leftism. Welsel derived a way to capture a commitment to emancipative values in a single number, based on his discovery that the answers to a cluster of survey items tend to correlate across people, countries, and regions of the world with a common history and culture. The items embrace gender equality, whether people feel that women should have an equal right to jobs, political leadership and a university education, personal choice, whether they feel that divorce, homosexuality, and abortion may be justified, political voice, whether they believe that people should be guaranteed freedom of speech and a say in government, communities, and the workplace, and child-rearing philosophy, whether they feel that children should be encouraged to be obedient or independent and imaginative. The correlations among these items are far from perfect. Abortion in particular divides people who agree on much else, but they tend to go together and collectively predict many things about a country. Before we look at historical changes in values, we have to keep in mind that the passage of time doesn't simply flip the pages of the calendar. As time goes by, people get older, and eventually they die and are replaced by a new generation. Any secular, in the sense of historical or long-term change in human behavior, then, can take place for three reasons. The trend can be a period effect, a change in the times, the zeitgeist, or the national mood that lifts or lowers all the boats. It can be an age or life cycle effect. People change as they grow from mewling infant to whining schoolboy to sighing lover to round-bellied justice and so on. Since there are booms and busts in a nation's birth rate, the population average will automatically change with the changing proportion of young, middle-aged, and old people, even if the prevailing values at each age are the same. Finally, the trend can be a cohort or generational effect. People born at a certain time may be stamped with traits they carry through their lives, and the average for the population will reflect the changing mixture of cohorts as one generation exits the stage and another enters. It's impossible to disentangle the effects of age, period, and cohort perfectly, because as one period transitions into the next, each cohort gets older. But by measuring a trait across a population in several periods, and separating the data from the different cohorts in each one, one can make reasonable inferences about the three kinds of change. Let's first look at the history of the most developed nations, such as those of North America, Western Europe, and Japan. Figure 15-6 shows the trajectory of emancipative values over a span of a century. It plots survey data collected from adults, ranging in age from 18 to 85, at two periods, 1980 and 2005, representing cohorts born between 1895 and 1980. American cohorts are commonly divided into the GI generation, born between 1900 and 1924, the Silent Generation, 1925 to 1945, the Baby Boomers, 1946 to 1964, Generation X, 1965 to 1979, and the Millennials, 1980 through 2000. The cohorts are arranged along the horizontal axis by birth year. Each of the two testing years is plotted on a line. Data from 2011 to 2014, which extend the series to late millennials born through 1996, are similar to those of 2005. The graph displays a historical trend that is seldom appreciated in the hurly-burly of political debate. For all the talk about right-wing backlashes and angry white men, the values of Western countries have been getting steadily more liberal, which, as we will see, is one of the reasons those men are so angry. The line for 2005 is higher than the line for 1980, showing that everyone got more liberal over time, and both curves rise from left to right, showing that younger generations in both periods were more liberal than older generations. The rises are substantial, about three-quarters of a standard deviation apiece for the 25 years of passing time and for each 25-year generation. The rises are also unappreciated. A 2016 Ipsos poll showed that in almost every developed country, people think their compatriots are more socially conservative than they really are. A critical discovery displayed in the graph is that the liberalization does not reflect a growing bulge of liberal young people who will backslide into conservatism as they get older. If that were true, the two curves would sit side by side instead of one floating above the other, and a vertical line representing a given cohort would impale the 2005 curve at a lower value, reflecting conservative old age, rather than the higher value we see, reflecting the more liberal zeitgeist. Young people take their emancipative values with them as they age, a finding we'll return to when we ponder the future of progress in Chapter 20. The liberalization trends shown in Figure 15-6 come from the Prius-driving, chai-sipping, kale-eating populations of post-industrial Western countries. What about the rest of humanity? Welzel grouped the 95 countries in the World Values Survey into 10 zones with similar histories and cultures. He also took advantage of the absence of a life cycle effect to extrapolate emancipated values backwards. The values of a 60-year-old in 2000 adjusted for the effects of 40 years of liberalization in his or her country as a whole provide a good estimate of the values of a 20-year-old in 1960. Figure 15-7 shows the trends in liberal values for the different parts of the world over a span of almost 50 years, combining the effects of the changing zeitgeist in each country, like the jump between curves in Figure 15-6 with the changing cohorts, the rise along each curve. The graph, unsurprisingly, reveals that differences across the world's culture zones are substantial. The Protestant countries of Western Europe, such as the Netherlands, Scandinavia, and the United Kingdom, are the world's most liberal, followed by the United States and other wealthy English-speaking countries, then Catholic and Southern Europe, then the former communist countries of Central Europe. Latin America, the industrialized countries of East Asia, and the former republics of the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia are more socially conservative, followed by South and Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. The world's most illiberal region is the Islamic Middle East. What is surprising, though, is that in every part of the world, people have become more liberal. A lot more liberal. Young Muslims in the Middle East, the world's most conservative culture, have values today that are comparable to those of young people in Western Europe, the world's most liberal culture, in the early 1960s. Though in every culture both the zeitgeist and the generations became more liberal, in some, like the Islamic Middle East, the liberalization was driven mainly by the generational turnover, and it played an obvious role in the Arab Spring. Can we identify the causes that differentiate the world's regions and liberalize them all over time? Many society-wide traits correlate with emancipative values, and, in a problem we encounter repeatedly, they tend to correlate with each other, a nuisance for social scientists who want to distinguish causation from correlation. Prosperity, measured as GDP per capita, correlates with emancipated values, presumably because as people become healthier and more secure, they can experiment with liberalizing their societies. The data show that more liberal countries are also, on average, better educated, more urban, less fecund, less inbred, with fewer marriages among cousins, more peaceful, more democratic, less corrupt, and less crime and coup-ridden. Their economies now, and in the past, tend to be built on networks of commerce rather than large plantations or the extraction of oil and minerals. Yet the single best predictor of emancipated values is the World Bank's Knowledge Index, which combines per capita measures of education, adult literacy and enrollment in high schools and colleges, information access, telephones, computers, and internet users, scientific and technological productivity, researchers, patents, and journal articles, and institutional integrity, rule of law, regulatory quality, and open economies. Velsel found that the knowledge index accounts for 70% of the variation in emancipative values across countries, making it a far better predictor than GDP. The statistical result vindicates a key insight of the Enlightenment: knowledge and sound institutions lead to moral progress. Any tour of progress in rights must look at the most vulnerable sector of humanity, children, who cannot agitate for their own interests but depend upon the compassion of others. We've already seen that children the world over have become better off. They are less likely to enter the world motherless, die before their fifth birthday, or grow up stunted for lack of food. Here we'll see that in addition to escaping these natural assaults, children are increasingly escaping human-made ones. They are safer than they were before, and likelier to enjoy a true childhood. The well-being of children is yet another case in which lurid headlines terrify newsreaders even as they have less to be terrified about. Media reports of school shootings, abductions, bullying, cyberbullying, sexting, date rape, and sexual and physical abuse make it seem as if children are living in increasingly perilous times. The data say otherwise. Teenagers' retreat from dangerous drugs, mentioned in Chapter 12, is just one example. In a 2014 review of the literature on violence against children in the United States, the sociologist David Finkelhor and his colleagues reported, of 50 trends in exposure examined, there were 27 significant declines and no significant increases between 2003 and 2011. Declines were particularly large for assault victimization, bullying, and sexual victimization. Three of those trends are shown in Figure 15-8. Another declining form of violence against children is corporal punishment. The spanking, smacking, paddling, birching, tanning, hiding, thrashing, and other crude methods of behavior modification that parents and teachers have inflicted on helpless children at least since the 7th century BCE advisory, "Spare the rod and spoil the child." Corporal punishment has been condemned in several United Nations resolutions and has been outlawed in more than half the world's countries. The United States, once again, is an outlier among advanced democracies in allowing children to be paddled in schools. But even here, approval of all forms of corporal punishment is in slow but steady decline. 9-year-old Oliver Twist's stint at picking oakum out of tarry ropes in an English workhouse is a fictional glimpse at one of the most widespread abuses of children, child labor. Together with Dickens's novel, Elizabeth Barrett Browning's 1843 poem, The Cry of the Children, and many journalistic exposés, awakened 19th-century readers to the horrific conditions under which children were forced to work in that era. Small children stood on boxes to tend dangerous machinery in mills, mines, and canneries, breathing air thick with cotton or coal dust, kept awake by splashes of cold water in their faces, collapsing into sleep after exhausting shifts with food still in their mouths. But the cruelties of child labor did not begin in Victorian factories. Children have always been set to work as farmhands and domestics, and they were commonly hired out as servants to other people or as laborers in cottage industries, often from the age when they could walk. In the 17th century, for example, children put to work in a kitchen would crank a spit with a slab of meat for hours, protected from the fire only by a bale of wet hay. No one thought of child labor as exploitation. It was a form of moral education, protecting children from idleness and sloth. Starting with influential treatises by John Locke in 1693 and Jean-Jacques Rousseau in 1762, childhood was reconceptualized. A carefree youth was now considered a human birthright. Play was an essential form of learning, and the early years of life shaped the adult and determined the future of society. In the decades around the turn of the 20th century, childhood was sacralized, as the economist Viviana Zelizer has put it, and children achieved their current status as economically worthless, emotionally priceless. Under pressure from children's advocates, and helped along by affluence, smaller families, an expanding circle of sympathy, and an increasing premium on education, Western societies gradually did away with child labor. A snapshot of these forces pushing in the same direction may be found in an advertisement for tractors in a 1921 issue of the magazine Successful Farming entitled, "Keep the Boy in School." The pressure of urgent spring work is often the cause of keeping the boy out of school for several months. It may seem necessary, but it isn't fair to the boy. You are placing a life handicap in his path if you deprive him of education. In this age, education is becoming more and more essential for success and prestige in all walks of life, including farming. Should you feel that your own education was neglected through no fault of yours, then you naturally will want your children to enjoy the benefits of a real education, to have some things you may have missed. With the help of a Case kerosene tractor, it is possible for one man to do more work in a given time than a good man and an industrious boy together working with horses. By investing in a Case tractor and ground detour plow and harrow outfit now, your boy can get his schooling without interruption, and the spring work will not suffer by his absence. Keep the boy in school, and let a Case kerosene tractor take his place in the field. You'll never regret either investment. In many countries, the coup de grace was legislation that made schooling compulsory, and thus made child laborers conspicuously illegal. Figure 15-9 shows that the proportion of children in the labor force in England was halved between 1850 and 1910, before child labor was outlawed altogether in 1918, and the United States followed a similar trajectory. The graph also shows the precipitous decline in Italy, together with two recent time series for the world. The lines are not commensurable because of differences in the age ranges and definitions of child labor, but they show the same trend, downward. In 2012, 16.7% of the world's children worked an hour a week or more, 10.6% engaged in objectionable child labor, long hours or tender age, and 5.4% engaged in hazardous work, far too many, but less than half the rate of just a dozen years before. Child labor, now as always, is concentrated not in manufacturing but in agriculture, forestry, and fishing, and it goes with national poverty, as both cause and effect. The poorer the country, the larger the percentage of its children who work. As wages rise or when governments pay parents to send their children to school, child labor plummets, which suggests that poor parents send their children to work out of desperation rather than greed. As with other crimes and tragedies of the human condition, progress in ending child labor has been empowered both by the global rise of affluence and by humanistic moral campaigns. In 1999, 180 countries ratified the Worst Forms of Child Labor Convention. The worst forms that were banned include hazardous labor and the exploitation of children in slavery, human trafficking, debt bondage, prostitution, pornography, drug trafficking, and war. Though the International Labor Organization's target of eliminating the worst forms by 2016 was not met, the momentum is unmistakable. The cause was symbolically ratified in 2014, when the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Kailash Satyarthi, the activist against child labor who had been instrumental in the adoption of the 1999 resolution. He shared the prize with Malala Yousafzai, the heroic advocate for girls' education. And that brings us to yet another advance in human flourishing, the expansion of access to knowledge. Chapter 16. Knowledge. Homo sapiens, knowing man, is the species that uses information to resist the rot of entropy and the burdens of evolution. Humans everywhere acquire knowledge about their landscape, its flora and fauna, the tools and weapons that can subdue them, and the networks and norms that entangle them with kin, allies, and enemies. They accumulate and share that knowledge with the use of language, gesture, and face-to-face tutelage. At a few times in history, people have hit on technologies that multiply, indeed, exponentiate the growth of knowledge, such as writing, printing, and electronic media. The supernova of knowledge continuously redefines what it means to be human. Our understanding of who we are, where we came from, how the world works, and what matters in life depends on partaking of the vast and ever-expanding store of knowledge. Though unlettered hunters, herders, and peasants are fully human, anthropologists often comment on their orientation to the present, the local, the physical. To be aware of one's country and its history, of the diversity of customs and beliefs across the globe and through the ages, of the blunders and triumphs of past civilizations, of the microcosms of cells and atoms and the macrocosms of planets and galaxies, of the ethereal reality of number and logic and pattern, such awareness truly lifts us to a higher plane of consciousness. It is a gift of belonging to a brainy species with a long history. It's been a long time since our culture's store of knowledge could be passed along by storytelling and apprenticeship. Formal schools are millennia old. I grew up with the Talmudic story of the first century Rabbi Hillel, who as a young man nearly froze to death after he climbed onto the roof of a school whose tuition he could not afford so that he could eavesdrop on lessons through the skylight. At various times, schools have been charged with instilling practical, religious, or patriotic wisdom in the young. But the Enlightenment, with its apotheosis of knowledge, would broaden their remit. With the coming of the modern age, the educational theorist George Counts observes, formal education assumed a significance far in excess of anything that the world had yet seen. The school, which had been a minor social agency in most of the societies of the past, directly affecting the lives of but a small fraction of the population, expanded horizontally and vertically, until it took its place along with the state, the church, the family, and property as one of society's most powerful institutions. Today, education is compulsory in most countries, and it is recognized as a fundamental human right by the 170 members of the United Nations that signed the 1966 International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. The mind-altering effects of education extend to every sphere of life, in ways that range from the obvious to the spooky. At the obvious end of the range, we saw in Chapter 6 that a little knowledge about sanitation, nutrition, and safe sex can go a long way toward improving health and extending life. Also obvious is that literacy and numeracy are the foundations of modern wealth creation. In the developing world, a young woman can't even work as a household servant if she is unable to read a note or count out supplies, and higher rungs of the occupational ladder require ever-increasing abilities to understand technical material. The first countries that made the great escape from universal poverty in the 19th century, and the countries that have grown the fastest ever since, are the countries that educated their children most intensely. As with every question in social science, correlation is not causation. Do better educated countries get richer, or can richer countries afford more education? One way to cut the knot is to take advantage of the fact that a cause must precede its effect. Studies that assess education at time one and wealth at time two, holding all else constant, suggest that investing in education really does make countries richer. At least it does if the education is secular and rationalistic. Until the 20th century, Spain was an economic laggard among Western countries, even though Spaniards were highly schooled, because Spanish education was controlled by the Catholic Church, and the children of the masses received only oral instruction in the creed, the catechism, and a few simple manual skills. Science, mathematics, political economy, and secular history were considered too controversial for anyone but trained theologians. Clerical meddling has similarly been blamed for the economic lag of parts of the Arab world today. At the more spiritual end of the range, education brings gifts that go well beyond practical know-how and economic growth. Better education today makes a country more democratic and peaceful tomorrow. The wide-ranging effects of education make it hard to discern the intervening links in the causal chain from formal schooling to social harmony. Some of the links may simply be demographic and economic. Better educated girls grow up to have fewer babies, and so are less likely to beget youth bulges with their surfeit of troublemaking young men. And better educated countries are richer, And as we saw in chapters 11 and 14, richer countries tend to be more peaceful and democratic. But some of the causal pathways vindicate the values of the Enlightenment. So much changes when you get an education. You unlearn dangerous superstitions, such as that leaders rule by divine right, or that people who don't look like you are less than human. You learn that there are other cultures that are as tied to their ways of life as you are to yours, and for no better or worse reason. You learn that charismatic saviors have led their countries to disaster. You learn that your own convictions, no matter how heartfelt or popular, may be mistaken. You learn that there are better and worse ways to live, and that other people and other cultures may know things that you don't. Not least, you learn that there are ways of resolving conflicts without violence. All these epiphanies militate against knuckling under the rule of an autocrat or joining a crusade to subdue and kill your neighbors. Of course, none of this wisdom is guaranteed, particularly when authorities promulgate their own dogmas, alternative facts, and conspiracy theories, and, in a backhanded compliment to the power of knowledge, stifle the people and ideas that might discredit them. Studies of the effects of education confirm that educated people really are more enlightened. They are less racist, sexist, xenophobic, homophobic, and authoritarian. They place a higher value on imagination, independence, and free speech. They are more likely to vote, volunteer, express political views, and belong to civic associations such as unions, political parties, and religious and community organizations. They are also likelier to trust their fellow citizens, a prime ingredient of the precious elixir called social capital, which gives people the confidence to contract, invest, and obey the law without fearing that they are chumps who will be shafted by everyone else. For all these reasons, the growth of education, and its first dividend, literacy, is a flagship of human progress. And as with so many other dimensions of progress, we see a familiar narrative. Until the Enlightenment, almost everyone was abject. Then a few countries started to pull away from the pack. Recently, the rest of the world has been catching up. Soon the bounty will be near universal. Figure 16-1 in the accompanying PDF shows that before the 17th century, literacy was the privilege of a small elite in Western Europe, less than an eighth of the population, and that was true for the world as a whole well into the 19th century. The world's literacy rate doubled in the next century and quadrupled in the century after that, so now 83% of the world is literate. Even that figure understates the literatization of the world because the illiterate fifth is mostly middle-aged or elderly. In many Middle Eastern and North African countries, more than three-quarters of the people over 65 are illiterate, whereas the rate for those in their teens and 20s is in the single digits. The literacy rate for young adults aged 15 to 24 in 2010 was 91%, about the same as for the entire population of the United States in 1910. Not surprisingly, the lowest rates of literacy are found in the world's poorest and most war-torn countries, such as South Sudan, 32%, Central African Republic, 37%, and Afghanistan, 38%. Literacy is the foundation for the rest of education, and Figure 16-2 shows the world's progress in sending children to school. The timeline is familiar. In 1820, more than 80% of the world was unschooled. By 1900, a large majority of Western Europe and the Anglosphere had the benefit of a basic education. Today, that's true of more than 80% of the world. The least fortunate region, Sub-Saharan Africa, has a rate comparable to that of the world in 1980, Latin America in 1970, East Asia in the 1960s, Eastern Europe in 1930, and Western Europe in 1880. According to current projections, by the middle of this century, only five countries will have more than a fifth of their population uneducated, and by the end of the century, the worldwide proportion will fall to zero. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. Unlike measures of well-being that have a natural floor of zero, like war and disease, or a natural ceiling of 100%, like nutrition and literacy, The quest for knowledge is unbounded. Not only does knowledge itself expand indefinitely, but the premium for knowledge in an economy that is driven by technology has been soaring. While global rates of literacy and basic education are converging to their natural ceiling, the number of years